You're listening to Unity Online Radio, the voice of an awakening world. Thank you for tuning in for this Unity Partner Program. Unity Online Radio partners with spiritual leaders from organizations whose mission and messages complement Unity's. We are pleased to bring you this program on Unity Online Radio, the voice of an awakening world.
Thank you for joining us for the Michael Chapman Giving Show. Each week, Michael will highlight the joy of giving, as well as shed light on some of today's humanitarian heroes and donors in both the private and corporate sectors. Michael will show you why giving of yourself is truly the best gift you can receive.
Welcome, everyone, to another edition of the Michael Chapman Giving Show. Really excited about today's guest, who is really a celebrity and famous in his own right. He wrote a best-selling book called The Human Magnet Syndrome. He is a psychotherapist specializing in relationships, has been featured on various TV networks like ABC, Fox News. Welcome to the show, Ross Rosenberg.
Well, thank you, Michael. It's such a pleasure to be on your show.
Well, good. Let's jump right into it. You have quite of a YouTube following. Let's talk about your YouTube work. You've quite a celebrity on there.
It's interesting because the original reason I got on YouTube was because a buddy of mine, an attorney, said, "Hey, you know, Ross, you can get on the first page of of Google." And of course, you know, I was thinking, well, I need to promote my book, my business, and so all I was thinking of trying to, you know, just for SEO purposes, to get people to see me. And I did a couple videos, and they were excerpts from seminars that were based on my book, The Human Magnet Syndrome. And all of a sudden, you know, people liked them. And I knew that the book, you know, had its reach. And then over time, I started to, like, realize that there was this whole, I mean, I was amazed that I was reaching people all throughout the world. It just boggled my mind that, you know, little therapist Ross Rosenberg in Arlington Heights, Illinois, is like writing something that people in Zimbabwe or Guam. And so then I just started to look at it differently. I thought, well, I have a platform to help people who couldn't or can't afford psychotherapy, who don't have or live in a country in which psychotherapy is not even culturally accepted. So I started to kind of add this idea that, of course, you know, I want to promote my book and my other services, but I was started to be more motivated to help people understand this disorder of codependency or what I now call self-love deficit disorder, understand it and learn how to heal from it so they can be free from the bondages of the disorder. And the more videos that I created, the more views and the more subscribers. And, you know, lo and behold, 3 years later, you know, who would have thought that, you know, a therapist, me, would have 5 million views and around 50,000 subscribers. So it's been quite a ride.
Yeah, I see that. And I'm really fascinated by how you have flipped the script, so to speak, Ross, and rebranded what we now know, what we have come to know about codependency, and now you call it self-love deficit disorder. Why did you feel like that was important to do that?
You know, I've been a therapist for about 29 years, and I'm a recovering codependent. And what that means is, you know, codependents are people that are, you know, chronically, habitually attracted to selfish, narcissistic people, and they don't even know it. They just fall in love with them, and they think they can heal them and help them, and they end up getting hurt, and by virtue of their codependency, they get stuck in these relationships, and they, without any help, they can live their life out, such as my mom and other people, in, like, misery. And I started to realize that the term codependency, the name itself, had no value. I mean, it's an old-school term, comes out of the medical model. It really originally meant the partner of an alcoholic. And the people that I hung around with, my colleagues, whenever I would mention codependency, everyone would say, well, that's kind of like, you know, BS pop psychology. And so I knew I had to change it. I just didn't know why. I mean, excuse me, I didn't know when or what. And one day it hit me. I literally almost fell off the chair. It was one of those moments of creativity. I realized codependency is caused by the lack of self-love. Mm. So anyone who's in a relationship with a harmful narcissist who's being gaslit or experiencing narcissistic abuse, at the core is they never learn to love themselves. And because of that lack of love, they're stuck because they don't think they can do any better, but they're afraid to venture out into healthy relationships. So I realized that all of this treatment and the therapy that I've been doing, both personally in my own recovery and, you know, with my clients, has been helping transform this lack of self-love, this self-love deficit, into self-love. And that's when the name became so clear. This is a self-love deficit disorder. And the goal, or as I call the cure, the self-love deficit disorder cure, the codependency cure, is to solve, to heal the trauma that created the condition to not love yourself, and then to become, and this is the cool thing, if I may say so myself,
yes,
is that there's a point at which self-love deficit disorder no longer exists. It becomes self-love abundancy or self-love abundance. So I don't even want a diagnosis. So someone identifies as self-love deficient or the disorder self-love deficit disorder, and they work through all of the things that you need to work with, then they're no longer self-love deficient. And so there's not even a reason to have a diagnosis. Why have a diagnosis? Why call yourself a recovering codependent or a recovering self-love deficient when it's not even there? So to me, it just made logical sense.
To be able to do that, let me interject here for a second, and we will get to the other questions that we had talked about. But I got to ask this. You had talked about a lot of your approach to therapy work is trying to get people to undo or get past the traumas. Now, I realize every situation might be different when you counsel clients. Are there any patterns that you've noticed with people who tend to have a lack of self-love?
Yeah, the people who are codependent or have self-love deficit disorder always, and I say always with great confidence, having come from a childhood in which they were psychologically neglected or deprived and abused during their formative years, their childhood, by a parent who was what I call a pathological narcissist.
Okay.
And I promise you, this is a pattern that shakes out in almost every situation. That codependent learned early on that their only value was if they can make the narcissist happy or keep them from not being mad or somehow just be the object child, the gift child, the pleasing child that the narcissist always wanted. So they form this template that I am only as good or I'm only worth love if I make other people happy. Mm. Now, that experience in childhood is trauma, and we call that attachment trauma because children need unconditional love. It's genetically programmed. We're wired that for us to be psychologically healthy, we need nurturing and unconditional love. The absence of unconditional love.
So how do you know, Ross, that you are linked to a narcissistic person? I mean, what are the characteristics and traits that define that type of person so you'll know who you're dealing with?
Okay. Well, the first thing is you're going to be unhappy, you're going to be sad, and you're going to be angry a lot. Okay, but narcissists or people with narcissistic personality disorder, they have a they don't really understand they have problems. They don't respond well to criticisms. In fact, they get very angry and upset and defensive if they're criticized. They're very, what we call grandiose. They think everything they do is better and bigger or more important than others. They're entitled. They think they need preferential treatment. They tend to need to be in the center of the spotlight. They need people to want them, want to see them, want to hear from them. And they are like sponges for positive and affirming feedback. Everything that they do, at the center of everything that they do, whether it seems nice or it's not, is about them. So yeah. The way to spot a narcissist is simply, it's so simple. According to the human magnet syndrome, we spot narcissists easily if we're not codependent. If we are healthy, the narcissist is really obvious to us because they bother us. They annoy us. But if you are the codependent and you were raised in the childhood, like I told you, there's something about them that feels familiar and they gravitate towards them because they think they can help them and they find them paradoxically safe. So if you're healthy, then the narcissist is really simple to point out because they're annoying.
Right. And if you are codependent, and I promise we'll get to some of the other questions, but if you are codependent, how do you break free from that narcissist?
And so the short answer of that is my first book, The Human Magnet Syndrome, explains the problem. It explains what is codependency, what is narcissism, and why they come together. All of my work now that's on YouTube and the book that I'm writing is the solution or the cure. So the simple answer is you have to solve the problem at its core. And the core, and I created this little pyramid to explain it. Codependency is a symptom. The core is attachment trauma. The attachment trauma, being raised by narcissists, creates this core shame that you are basically a bad person unless you make other people feel good. Core shame creates this pervasive feeling, we're going up the pyramid, this pervasive feeling of loneliness, deep loneliness. The loneliness creates this motivation to find someone to take the loneliness away, and that is the narcissist. You get addicted and in need of that relationship, and that becomes codependency. So the answer is to solve codependency or self-love deficit disorder is not to do what most therapists are doing. It's work on the symptoms. It's work on the cause of it, and that is the trauma, some of which you don't remember, that happened to you at an early age that formed your template for your self-worth, your self-love, or the lack of it. So that type of therapy requires a therapist with trauma background that can help you peel back the layers to get to the source. Because if you don't love yourself, and it's because you were raised to not love yourself, and you've lived your whole life in relationships with people that haven't promoted self-love, we have to figure out a way to undo the forces that compelled you to not love yourself. And that's solving the trauma, the childhood trauma.
Wow, very well stated. I just find your work very fascinating. And just to think, Ross, we just met on Twitter. So I find your work just fascinating. Thank you for sharing that. Now, you're very popular. You have done well in your practice. And one of the questions I wanted to ask is, how do you go about reconciling your motivation to make money through your multiple business ventures and your need to be philanthropic? Because obviously you give back and you do a lot of philanthropy.
Well, you know, it's a question. It's so funny. I mean, I don't think there's coincidence. As a spiritual person, I kind of think this connection between you and I should have happened. Or I, in the very beginning, when I started my career, I remember thinking, I came from a family that was all about money, 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 money. And I decided, you know, screw money. I want to change the world. I want to be a therapist and I want to make the world a better place. And then of course, like a lot of idealistic 20-year-olds, you get into life and you realize, well, you need a car, you need insurance, you need an apartment, and money becomes important. But in the back of my mind, everything that I've done in building my career, my business is as much as I wanted to earn money, I wanted to make a difference. I kind of always thought that every client that I work with. So say a codependent, and say they're 30, and they have an 8-year-old and a 10-year-old, and I'm able to help them heal that trauma, that unconscious trauma that they weren't even aware of, that compelled them to hate themselves, that compelled them to find a narcissist. If I change that, I'm not only changing that person and their trajectory for the rest of their life and their ability to be happy, but I'm impacting their children. And their children are going to be healthier people. And so I see it as kind of like this ripple effect. They even wrote a poem about this that's posted on my Human Magnet Syndrome blog called Heaven. I always kind of thought that the way that we are going to live forever, because I don't really believe in the Christian version of heaven, but if we are going to live forever and have a positive impact, it's through what we do and how it impacts people and how that keeps giving. So if I help the person who then is a better mother, these children become parents, and for me, I started to figure out early on that for every one person I help, I'm going to change the world. So if I help one person, I've changed the world. 200 years from now, who knows how many people. So early on, I always had this idea that I was doing important work that was going to be exponential in its growth. And then, of course, I solved my self-love deficit disorder. I realized I was actually smart and talented. I started to write, wrote a book, YouTube video, et cetera, et cetera. And next thing you know, I'm like, have hundreds of thousands of people, millions of people looking at my stuff. And so I never imagined in all my life that I would impact so many people. So I spend countless amount of hours and money developing and producing these YouTube videos, for which I get paid very little bit of money. And so that in itself is my conscious, my proactive conscious approach to philanthropy, is put these videos out for people that can't afford therapy and change the world. And to be honest, Michael, and I'm almost embarrassed to admit this, I don't really know how to handle all the letters I get. I get hundreds of them a week. People who say, thank you for this, you've changed my life, my therapist didn't know this. I mean, I'm living a dream. I mean, to know that I've actually helped so many people, and to be honest, and I'm making decent money, it's like, you know, I've been rewarded or something. So yes, that I think that's the answer to the question. I kind of forgot the question.
No, that was good. That was good. We were talking about your philanthropy and how you arrived at that point. I want to go back to your YouTube videos, because I was reading in your media kit that you've had about 5 million views with about 48,000 subscribers. So the question that I would have, and you are doing a remarkable work, Ross, with offering these free videos for those who cannot afford therapy to listen in. I guess the question I would have is, are your videos enough as opposed to being able to sit down with a therapist in a one-on-one session?
No, and they're not. So it's a complicated question, and it's a complicated answer. There is no replacement for the psychotherapy needed to access trauma, the unconscious trauma, and to heal it. I know that, and there's no way I can do that on YouTube. But what I can do is I can give people the information, the education on everything else that I do that will put them on the path of hope, freedom, and recovery. Just the idea that they don't have codependency, but they have self-love deficit disorder, it focuses them on the lack of self-love. That in itself, I'm told, has changed people's lives, because now they have something concrete that they can focus on. They can go to their therapist, and they can work on it and feel so much better. But on my videos, or in my videos, I mention trauma and the necessity to see a therapist. So the way I look at it is, my videos are very, very helpful and life-changing, but the full recovery of SLDD requires psychotherapy. But you need both information, inspiration, and hope. And it, for people that can't afford it, or, I mean, I'm not taking on clients now. I mean, I have therapists in my Arlington Heights office. I own a counseling center who are trained and supervised by me because, so people that can come in and see one of my therapists, that's great. But if they take my information and they meditate on it, they apply it, I know it changes people's lives. So it's a tricky answer. It changes people's lives.
No, and I think it's a fair one. I think it's a fair one, Ross, if I may just interject for a second.
Sure.
I know it's difficult to measure the level of trauma for each individual. Do you recommend a certain amount of sessions for those who need to sit down with a therapist to find and heal the trauma?
Actually, if you don't mind, Michael, I'm going to backtrack a little bit, and then I'm going to answer your question.
Okay,
so, so I recognized that there's no one really except my staff trained in this method that I created that resolves the trauma. And I like I said, I get hundreds of emails, and a lot of these emails, like, who do you know? And it's whether Thailand, Columbus, Ohio, anywhere. Who do you know that does what you do? Because I desperately need help. And I haven't been able to give anyone any referrals because I don't know anyone. So what I decided, the way to reconcile this is I have to create a certification program so I can train therapists to do this. So I'm in the process of working that out and building a CSLDD treatment training program, because if I can get therapists in different parts of the United States knowing this, then I can give them the help that they need that I can't do individually.
Now you're trained to train the program that you're speaking of. If we have therapists who might be listening that's interested in getting involved, what type of credentialing would they need in order to be eligible to participate in this program?
I'm pretty strict, kind of strict. You need to be in a social work, mental health, psychological field in which you provide psychotherapy. You got to be a counselor, or psychotherapist, whether you're a psychologist, social worker, psychiatrist, or I decided to do what other therapists don't do because they scoff at coaches. I don't. Or I said, if you are a coach, a life coach with a certain amount of experience, and then there's an interview process, because I'm just not going to take people. I mean, this is serious business. I mean, this is the philanthropic part of it. This is not about money. It's like, I don't want to train someone that doesn't have the mental health or the psychological ability to do it. So the answer to your question is a psychotherapist or a life coach with a lot of experience, but all have to go through an interview process so that I determine it's a good fit.
Yeah, and that's fair. That's fair. Now, when we were preparing for this show, I know there was a question that was submitted to us, and I just want to say this, Ross. This is not a political show. We don't take sides, Democrat, Republican, Independent, Green Party, any of that, because we have listeners who belong to all of those affiliations. But I know recently during the election, you took a stance.
I did.
And you lost some YouTube followers, things like that. So don't want to get political on this.
I hear you loud and clear. I'm not going to get political. I describe myself as a bleeding heart liberal. But what that really means is it doesn't mean I'm a Democrat. It means, according to my own interpretation of that, is I have this belief that we need to take care of everyone and the downtrodden, the poor, the disadvantaged, the mentally ill. And so my political leanings are highly, highly aligned with people, whether they're Republicans or Democrats, who embrace that, you know, that purely human responsibility that we're all brothers and sisters. And, you know, during the presidential race, you know, it became pretty clear that a lot of people were feeling more and more disenfranchised. Some were actually feeling scared that, you know, one of the candidate choices might not espouse such, you know, ideology. So I actually did a video talking about the two candidates and explained my position on on what was motivating them. And I was very clear on a position. I don't usually do politics, but this is the part I want your listeners to listen. It's not about Donald Trump. It's not about Hillary Clinton. My constituents, I sound like a politician now, my people, my followers, they are hurt. They are traumatized. They were wounded by narcissists. These are the people that look for me for guidance. These are the ones that all their life they have been told, you know, that they're not good, they're bad. And so what I did was I made a stand on that. I made a stand because I wanted to give a voice to the people who were scared that that one of the presidential choices could represent a backslide into human rights, a backslide into, you know, gender, sexual, cultural acceptance. And but more than that, I got so many emails about how they were being triggered by what some of the campaign about the campaign. They were actually being triggered and going back to their own abuse, their memories of their own abuse of someone hurting them, not accepting them. Mm-hmm. And so for me, I did it for the people who were upset at the results of the election, who went into a state of depression or what I would call a PTSD, a post-traumatic stress disorder reaction. There was a huge, and I mean huge, phenomenon of depression after the election. And these were the people I was talking about, talking to. And I lost. Actually, I don't really care, to be honest. But I lost a lot of followers, and to me, that's fine because the people that I want to follow me are people that accept my message. I'm not looking to sell out. But for me, that's part of my responsibility is to speak up for the people that can't, who are afraid to.
Let me just interject, and I agree with you on that, Ross. That we, regardless of what our affiliation might be, we should be standing up for our values and representing this. We're actually going to be running out of time here shortly because I do want to make sure I get this question in, not to cut you off. But
sure.
You do so much. You know, you're speaking, you're training, your train-to-trainer program, your books, your YouTube videos. When it's all said and done, what will be the legacy for Ross Rosenberg?
Okay, you forgot one thing, which is actually the part that I spend all my work on. Most of my work is I actually run a counseling center.
Yeah, you're a counseling center, entrepreneur.
In Arlington Heights, yeah, and so that's actually my full-time job. My legacy is, and I always thought this, and I go back to what Elizabeth Kubler-Ross said, who wrote the seminal book, now I'm forgetting the name of it, but it talks about dying, the six stages of dying, or something like that. A brilliant woman is. Yeah. I have this idea that this is actually my home, my poem Heaven, which is I just
posted. We got 30 seconds, unfortunately.
Okay, so my legacy is that upon my deathbed, I look back and I smile that I made the world a better place. That's my legacy. Is I want to leave knowing I made the world a better place. That's it.
Good. And that's good. I'm afraid I'm going to have to end it there, Ross. Thank you so much for being on my show today. I wish we had more time. We don't. We've been talking with Ross Rosenberg, the author of the best-selling book, The Human Magnet Syndrome, Why We Love People Who Hurt Us. Thank you for being on the show today, Ross.
Thank you, Michael. It's been a pleasure.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening to the Michael Chapman Giving Show. Join Michael at 11 a.m. Central on Thursdays as he helps you uncover the joys of giving, featuring today's best-known philanthropists, private donors, public foundations, and a host of others. To give really is to receive.